This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy, money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires.
Welcome back, y'all. It is the final episode of Maggie and the Millionaires, at least for a little while. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're going to do a little regrouping after the election. It's been a tough couple of days. Again, I hope everybody out there is doing all right. Today, we've got a special guest, a seasoned political operative, to help us unpack all that has occurred. His name is Adam Green. He's the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a grassroots organization with a million members that engages in electoral and issue advocacy work with a focus on economic populism and democracy issues. Thanks for being here, Adam. I want to jump right in on the populism. How does a guy who is a billionaire who has a golden toilet take on the moniker of being a populist, especially when his number one accomplishment in his first term was giving billionaires and himself an enormous tax cut?
Well, we're all probably sick of the word vibes to describe the 2024 campaign, but there's a reason it's been said so much. You know, even though everything you said is true, here's a guy who shows up at McDonald's, rides around arguably ill-fatedly on a garbage truck, shows up at a plant that's outsourcing jobs back in 2016, and applies to his rhetoric every single day things that feel like he's speaking at a gut level to workers. And one of the problems that Democrats need to solve is, how do we actually have authentic populists who working class people don't believe are just reading from a teleprompter or speaking past their issues, but are really leaning into their issues from the gut? Right? I think John Tester in Montana, a guy who still tills his own land on his farm, and independent Dan Osborne, who almost picked up a Senate seat unexpectedly in Nebraska and is a mechanic, ran as an independent, didn't want the Democratic Party brand. These are people who really should be the types of faces we look for as a Democratic Party in the future.
Yeah, it was a bit of a heartbreaker locally to see three candidates here in congressional races in newly redrawn districts, Adam. Rebecca Cook, a waitress, Kristen Lierley, an OBGYN, and Peter Barca, who is basically the epitome of a centrist and a guy that works across the aisle, and not a one of them were able to pull off a win. But I think at least here locally, there was some urgency and interest in what these people were saying, because again, they sound normal. They sound like someone that you would talk to sitting next to you on a bar stool or in a house of worship. Again, people seem to trust Donald Trump on the economy, despite the fact that basically every single data point indicates that we shouldn't trust him. 23 Nobel economists said, don't trust this guy in his economic policies. Why do you think people continue to trust him? Is it simply because Democrats talk strangely and condescendingly to people, and we've got to get better candidates and speak more plainly and inclusively? Like, what's going on with the trust for Donald Trump, which seems irrational to me?
Yeah. Well, first, just one note on your Wisconsin point. It's unfortunate when good candidates with good messaging who have authentic brands do fall because of the top of the ticket and really the Democratic Party brand at large. I think Tammy Baldwin had a unique enough brand of her own that she was able to withstand the tide. But someone like Rebecca Cook, who, as you said, was a waitress, and you know, she was just introducing herself to voters. She wasn't a pre-known brand. And it's really unfortunate in a year like this when that happens. So I just want to acknowledge that sometimes there's nothing you can do when the brand itself at the top of the ticket is broken, and the person at the top, Kamala Harris in this case, wasn't able to really change it. You know, that leads directly to your next point about Trump. I mean, here's a guy who most people on a vibes level saw on TV being a good business person, right? I mean, that, even though it was a fictional version of Donald Trump, that is the story that many people have in their heads. He is a person who, like him or not, understands showmanship and symbolism, And, you know, in a world where people like you and myself might be reading very wonky articles about how many trillions of dollars might be in the Build Back Better proposal, Donald Trump is not speaking on that level. He is just speaking from the gut. And I'll tell you, first of all, we worked very closely with the White House this year and successfully got a lot of words in the teleprompter of Joe Biden during the State of the Union and Kamala Harris on the campaign trail, things about fighting billionaires, taxing them, things about taking on corporate price gouging in groceries, things like protecting and expanding Social Security benefits. But that extra layer of just people hearing an authentic messenger is the thing we have to solve next. And having gone door to door in Michigan and Omaha, Nebraska, and talking to people at the doors, it was so clear to me that many of the things I focus on in life and, you know, a lot of us focus on aren't breaking through to the people that we need to go out to the polls. And some guy who my door knock interrupted his Dungeons and Dragons game and he called the economy trash and blamed Joe Biden. You know, that's years and years of
programming,
failed branding on our part.
Yeah. And failed branding on our part, failed communication on our part. You know, just 4 years ago, right, in 20, Donald Trump lost voters making less than $50,000 a year by, I think, nearly 10 points to Joe Biden. And on Tuesday, he won that demographic by a percentage point. I mean, this is the sort of data point illustrating your anecdote about the person playing Dungeons and Dragons and saying the economy's trash and it's Joe Biden's fault. What should we take away from that shift? And what should do you know what the branding should be, Adam? Have you solved this entire problem for us? Please enlighten me so that I can say things correctly.
I would probably join you in being very sleep deprived yesterday. And, you know, all early takes today are just a down payment on lots of thoughts that we'll have together over the next, you know, days, weeks, months. So with that giant caveat, you know, we've seen so many examples of Democrats over the years just not getting the branding question. And, you know, one of our critiques of Harris this cycle, even though we worked with her extremely closely in her campaign, is if you think about the closing argument, right, the Harris campaign was very clear that they had a three-legged stool. They had abortion, they had democracy, they had the economy. They went to Texas to underscore her position on abortion, right? It was newsworthy because why is she in Texas? Oh, it's only because of their extreme abortion ban. She went to the Ellipse to underscore January 6th and the economy thing. But both of those, not the economy, the democracy issue, both of those were really smart moves. Where was the similar moment, or I would argue moments over the last several months, that were driving a fight around the economy? Why didn't she have a rally in front of the headquarters of a corporate price gouger or in front of a billionaire's office, an event in a grocery store, things that would allow her to actually break through on the gut level populism? Well, there was actually a fairly damning article today by Franklin Foer in The Atlantic that pretty much revealed that her brother-in-law, Tony West, who's a top lobbyist for Uber, had a big role in kind of honing and paring down her language, taking on big corporations and billionaires. And that's a real problem, right? So they thought they could coast by on just democracy and abortion and campaign with billionaires like Mark Cuban and, you know, kind of get a buy on fighting the fight. Well, meanwhile, Dan Osborne did 14 points better than her in Nebraska by every single day, every event, every almost word out of his mouth, taking on corporate greed and the fat cats. And that's a lesson for us. We need to have not just have policy positions, but a strategy of picking smart fights so there's commotion around them, story arcs, sagas, drama, and people are actually excited to tune into that drama and give us credit.
We need some kayfabe, like to borrow from wrestling. Like we need a storyline that is planned out with clear villains, and the villains that all Americans agree are villains are freaking billionaires. They don't care if it's Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, right? Like, and I've made the argument repeatedly that once you hit a certain level of wealth, it's like amoral, right? It's not immoral, it's just amoral. It doesn't have party anymore because at a certain level of wealth, the wealth seeks more wealth and power. It's the only thing that it can consume because you've consumed everything else that you could possibly want. So I totally agree with you on that. I remember, I think it was the New York Times. There was a small article that came out that said that those meetings were happening. I cannot wait to read this piece in The Atlantic. I'm going to do it as soon as I get off the air today, Adam. And the reporting was indicating that some of these meetings had happened, or that the messaging had gotten softened, right, around this very constellation of issues, in a way that some around the campaign were frankly uncomfortable with, because those are the issues that truly are not partisan. It's the thing that brings, frankly, the middle class together, right? And of course, all the stinking money in politics. It's a two-headed hydra, right? And it grows more heads. But to get back here, there's going to be, I think, an instinct to ask Democrats to actually pivot right, or to like make policy adjustments. What's your thinking on this, Adam?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question. And you mentioned these things aren't partisan. One challenge I would give to all of your viewers and listeners is to push back relentlessly on any conversation that involves the words left, right, and center, because those are such broken terms, right? Over 80% of people want to tax billionaires more. 90% want to protect Social Security. You could say those are left positions on some ideological spectrum, I guess, but that's where the center of the country is. Right. And they try to marginalize us by talking about right and left, right? Some of the people who were working hardest to give more giveaways to pharma and Wall Street during the Biden economic fights were called centrists and moderates on TV. No, those are like corporate fringe people doing stuff that nobody wants, right? So we need to redefine the language to be less left versus right, more top versus bottom, more elites versus working class. One example I would just put into the conversation as a kind of a talking point in these conversations with the people I have around their dinner table or kitchen table with other people is, you know, the 1999 Wall Street deregulation was bipartisan in Washington, D.C. Democrats and Republicans, right, who took bank money, corporate money, were thrilled to vote for this thing. Well, it was also bipartisan, unpopular in the country, which led to both the Tea Party movement and the Occupy movement, right? Yes. This will just rattle some people's brains. It makes sense in the bottom universe. It makes sense for
Republicans, right? Let's put it right there. We got to take care of some business. I want to come right back to this point, Adam, because we have to resist the official on of left, right, and center labels, because the entire spectrum got blown out of the water. It's about the top and the bottom, folks. We're all on the bottom. I'll be right back with Adam here on Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to Maggie and the Millionaires Talk Money here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's going to be the last Maggie and the Millionaires Talk Money episode for a little while. We're going to regroup. It's been an absolute pleasure. My thanks to everybody at the PMs for helping find these amazing guests like our guest today, Adam Green. He is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, a grassroots organization that focuses on economic populism and democracy issues. Let's get right back into it. You and I love it when I have guests on like yourself, Adam, and we've never talked about this before, but I can hear an expert helping to confirm some of my gut instincts about things. So thank you. We were talking about the fact that using left, right, center, conservative, progressive, when we're talking about particular policies or thinking of the political environment in these days in those terms, is limiting, and it will not help Democrats try to break through. What do you think are the issues that can help Democrats break through and that doesn't involve effectively abandoning the core values or tenets of the Democratic Party. Yesterday, I said, we're not wrong. We have just forgotten how to talk to everybody like regular people and with the respect that people who we disagree with actually deserve. It's really challenging, but we're not wrong. It is a message and messenger challenge.
Absolutely. It is a message and messenger challenge. You use the word issues, which is a really important differentiation from a lot of the labels that are out there. So yes, left, right, center. I'm glad you mentioned even progressive. There's even brands that are on certain things like Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, that I think we just have to be willing to sometimes recognize when there's a broken brand out there, right? Green New Deal, this is my opinion here, but was on track to be a really good brand until a ridiculous rollout, including an accidentally leaked early version of it that led to it being about cow farts and stuff like that, right?
I saw that and I nearly died. I was like, oh my gosh, unforced error.
Unforced error, and we don't have to resuscitate the brand. You know, I have heard politicians say to me, I'm going to support so many ideas in the Green New Deal, but I'm not going to embrace the Green New Deal as a brand. It's like, fine, that's what we need, right? We had one person in the Midwest call it the Midwest Marshall Plan. Okay, sure, if that floats your boat, we don't need a purity test on the brand. And just to really drill this point, I was struck by one of the earliest examples of this during the big healthcare fight during the Obama years. We were a lead group pushing for the public option, which at that point was the left flank, if one's going to use that term, of the healthcare debate happening in Congress. And the New York Times poll showed that over 70% of Americans supported a public option. It was explained to them. This included 50% of Republican voters wanted a publicly run government insurance company to compete against private insurance. It was called government run right in the description. Yep. The same poll, if you look in the demographics, show only 20% of people call themselves liberal, right? Mm-hmm. And we've done some testing, progressive liberal, it's always 20%. So I don't care if someone doesn't join the progressive caucus, but wants to take on big insurance companies and big pharma. Sure, there's actually, our organization has worked with tons of them who just won in red to blue districts who didn't want the word progressive on their name because it's just a misunderstood brand. I mean, you can ask me, well, you work for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Thank you. We might have some rebranding to do because really, like, these labels are hurting us.
Yes.
The ideas, even a government-run insurance program, helps us. So that competes against private insurance, to be clear in that case. So, you know, once you recognize that, it partly solves the values problem because we're not abandoning a lot of the issue positions. We're abandoning bad descriptions and things that kind of don't speak correctly in the ears of people when they hear the shorthand, right? But and then marrying that to the earlier point we were talking about, a lot of this is the gut, right? When I was thinking about this recently, when Bernie Sanders talked about Medicare for All, he wasn't talking about a 200-page bill.
Yes.
He wasn't trying to describe a plan. He was giving an us versus them narrative of the little guy being screwed over by the big guy. It all boiled down to that. And Medicare for All was almost a supporting detail in that narrative, not the other way around. So I feel like that's just what we need to have, right? So if politicians are inclined to talk wonky stuff, they shouldn't be our politicians. And if politicians also just aren't comfortable with the ideas enough to have a real human conversation with people, they shouldn't be our politicians. So going back to the messenger and message, and sorry, I'll stop talking after this. You know, Kamala Harris, even if one believes, I really have zero interest in like bashing Kamala Harris. Even if one believes that she ran the best campaign that was possible with her. We all remember in 2019, 2020, she was the very first senator to endorse Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill, right? She saw a political opportunity in that. And then when pressed one iota to defend it, she couldn't. And then she reversed her position, right?
Yes.
We don't need that. We don't need that, right? The reason she was reading from a teleprompter about corporate price gouging was it wasn't in her gut to talk about it. She couldn't make the case to talk about it. And therefore it wasn't in her gut to say to her press people, wait a second, why am I talking about democracy and abortion but not having any events on challenging corporate power, right? We need politicians who live it on a gut level, can communicate it on a gut level, and the policy will backfill itself later when we're in governing mode.
Got to start with the ideas. And it is us versus them, right? And it is all of us, regardless of party. This is, again, the fight, I think, of a generation to look at both money and politics, a constitutional amendment to fix that and start with a fairer tax code that works for the middle class folks. That is Adam Green. He is the co-founder of the soon-to-be-renamed Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Thanks so much, Adam, folks. Keep it locked. U.S. Attorney Jim Santel joins us next to talk about the implications of Trump's election for those criminal prosecutions right here on The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Change,
change, change. That was fun.
It was
fun.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
What's up, y'all? Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're in the last couple of blocks of the afternoon. Folks, I've got a special guest host sitting in the chair for me tomorrow. You know him better as Matt Rothschild. And I'm going to have my very next guest hosting for me on Monday because this gal needs a little break, a little battery recharge time. My very
Absolutely.
Next guest is...
Right, Maggie? Right.
Yes, former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show, my friend.
Maggie, delighted to be with you once again to chat about stuff going on in America, as always, right?
Never a dull moment.
Never a dull moment. In and outside of the courts, both in both venues, right?
Everywhere, all day, every day. Jim, I heard reporting yesterday at about 11 a.m. from MSNBC that a source within the DOJ was telling the media that the federal cases against Donald Trump were basically being mothballed.
Right.
Tell us why, what the status is, your thoughts, and let's start with sort of the legal procedural stance of the January 6th case.
Oh, sure.
Then we'll talk a little bit about the super secret spy documents case.
Right.
And what folks can expect. But procedurally, Jim, we know that he had a superseding indictment. Jack Smith had went and got a superseding indictment.
Cleaned up all the stuff that the Supreme Court caused, right? Decision. Exactly. Right.
I can't hear Jim Cardi, which makes it difficult to have a conversation. Let's try that again. Jim, you there?
I am here. I am
nope,
here.
Still can't All hear right. Jim. Right. We had him before. We'll get there. Jim, you just keep talking. And when I hear you, I will stop
All right.
Talking,
that's good. I think I've got the mode of what
we're... I still do not have Jim.
Chatting about. And it has to do, as you indicated, with this insurrection case. And also the other federal case, of course, coming out of South Florida. That's the documents case. And the news, Maggie, that you are hearing, of course, is perhaps not entirely surprising. Jack Smith is the special counsel. He's the attorney appointed by the attorney general. And he is the one who has been leading these prosecutions up until, even to this point, still on those cases. The news that you're talking about, Maggie, is inside the Department of Justice. beginning to think about bringing those cases to a conclusion. And that may be accurate. I suspect it probably is. Why? Because there's this general principle inside the Department of Justice. It's not legislative. It's not constitutional. Supreme Court hasn't said you got to do this. But Attorneys General, Department of Justice, for many, many years have said there's a policy against prosecuting a sitting president. And so if that's the case, Donald Trump in about 72 days is going to be a sitting president. If that is the case, then likely those cases cannot go ahead. And that's the principal focus behind them. And then we can talk more about the specifics of those and how that might happen going forward. And I'm hoping, Maggie, we can chat about this, too, if we've got the connection between you and me. Yes?
Well, I am listening to you on the phone while we are on the air here.
Great. And that'll work. That'll work just fine. I'll continue to answer your very good initial question, which is about the status. Let's talk about that insurrection case, right? Yeah, this is the big one, right? This is the matter in front of Tanya Chutkan. She has been for recent weeks soliciting views on what she should do with this immunity decision that you just made reference to. She is asking the parties to tell her what she should do. Is the Supreme Court telling her basically she's got to dismiss the case? Jack Smith has filed this omnibus memorandum already saying, no, you don't have to do that. As you just indicated, Maggie, we've got the superseding indictment response to all that. Just set a trial date. That's what he said a number of weeks ago. And interestingly, Donald Trump's attorneys, as of this time, still scheduled to file their brief and their materials at the end of this month. She has not yet rendered a decision on that. Presumably, she still can and maybe will if indeed the Department of Justice doesn't go ahead and dismiss this before then. And the question again is whether or not that terrible, obnoxious, outrageous decision coming out on July 1, immunity for presidents for criminal conduct. Does that mean that the insurrection case has to go away in major part or entirely? And my sense is she's going to say no. She's going to say no, there's nothing about that. As stunning as it is, it prevents her from going ahead and presiding over that trial. But again, the thing that may oversee and again overcome all of this is if she makes that decision right now, she can presumably schedule this on for trial. If the department and Merrick Garland decide that this policy about not prosecuting a sitting president is to stay, and again, it's a policy, it's not a mandate, if that holds, then at some point we are going to see Jack Smith file a motion to dismiss that prosecution. And you and I both know what that's all about. A motion to dismiss. The judge has to give leave of court to dismiss because there is some judicial involvement in that. But likely that will go away. And that probably will happen sometime. Could be tomorrow, more likely in the weeks just ahead. And that's the status of that one. The parallel case also, again, prosecuted by Jack Smith. You also asked about it. It's the documents case. That one's in a different procedural posture. You and I both know that Eileen Cannon, again, made another outrageous decision. She said that, no, you can't prosecute this case because the attorney general did not properly appoint you, Jack Smith, had it been by the president, a position that is endorsed by no one else, in with the exception of Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. That's pending before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals right now. Jack Smith took that up. And so they're having oral arguments. They're filing the briefs that you and I file all the time. They'll decide that case. And again, absent the Department of Justice filing a motion with the Court of Appeals to dismiss, the Court of Appeals at some point will render a decision, either say, Eileen Cannon, you're right, unlikely, or Eileen Cannon, you're wrong, send it back to the trial court. Again, the thing that supersedes all of that is if Jack Smith says, well, gee, even if the 11th Circuit sends that back, we still have got to get a trial date at some point. And if that is the circumstance, that trial's not going to happen before January 20th. Department of Justice very likely, again, moving the 11th Circuit, maybe then moving the district court to dismiss the case, leave of court being granted, and those two federal cases will go away. Donald Trump doesn't even then have to direct his attorney general or his Department of Justice to go in and bring those to a conclusion, which is what we've all been talking about throughout this campaign. They may go away under the Garland administration. How interesting is that?
Yeah, so, and there are a couple of things that I wanted to dig in here with you about, Jim, because I'm not asking you to comment on the editorializing that I'm about to do unless you wish to. And that is, I think Merrick Garland's going to go down as one of the weakest U.S. attorneys, or excuse me, attorney generals in modern history, especially when you compare him with the likes of Darth Vader, a.k.a. Bill Barr.
Right.
And if I'm Merrick Garland, I'm not doing what the news is reporting is happening. I'm not mothballing those cases. I'm not permitting Jack Smith to ask for a voluntary dismissal of these cases. I would be making Donald Trump actually get rid of the cases.
Right.
The second thing I want to say, the 11th Circuit may just sit on it, right? They could just not issue a decision until Donald Trump actually is sworn in. I think that that would be unwise. I think they should take up the decision by Eileen Cannon and slam her back down as they've done already. And that we need that because Trump is considering appointing her, of course, to either to be attorney general herself, which she's utterly, completely disqualified herself from becoming, or worse yet, a Supreme Court justice, right? Dear God, help us.
Shortlist on both of those, right? Yep.
No kidding. But here was the other point I wanted to make and then just get your reactions to all this sort of commentary. I am absolutely 100% certain, and if there were odds making on this, I'd put a lot of money on it. Judge Chutkan will rule on this before Donald Trump is inaugurated. She is going to press the hand. She will not allow this case to go away without a ruling. And I would expect that ruling to be lengthy, specific, and in only the way that Article III judges can do, with simmering rage.
Absolutely. And she's done it before, right? Remember the first time that she issued this great opinion. It's incredibly readable. It is for the ages, right? She's the first one wrote, 50-page opinion saying, no, there's no immunity for presidents who are sitting in the White House. And she's going to do the same thing. I think that's exactly what she's going to do. She may be in sharpening her pen an awful lot right now because she doesn't want to get that motion from the Department of Justice. But this is also a judge, Maggie, you and I both know, who has said, you know what, she didn't say I don't care about the campaign, but I'm going to treat you like every other defendant. And I'm not going to change my schedule based upon the fact that you've got an election, you've got a campaign to undergo, different from Juan Merchant in New York.
Yes.
She is the judge who said, I've got a case to administer, and the politics are interesting. Do I know about them? Sure, I do. But I'm not going to have that direct what I'm going to do. And so I think, and frankly, I hope, I would endorse exactly what you said, that sometime, frankly, soon, when all the pleadings are done, she gets this submission by the defense in December, mid-December. She's got this underway. You and I could write this overnight probably and put it in place. Issue that before the end of the year. And do that, and then indeed, if the case goes away, you have articulated not only the fundamental principle that there's nothing about what the Supreme Court did that should have deep six to this prosecution, that's number one. Number two, you're also sending that signal to America that there is some legitimacy in treating every defendant in the same way across the country, including somebody who's going to be sworn in as the President of the United States of America. Those are powerful messages to send, and I agree with you entirely on all of that, including, frankly, going back to the place that employed me for 30 years. One of the things that we look back in history as to Merrick Garland and the department generally waited too long. Right. And it was the House committee that basically said, wait a minute, this is not just those people who are attacking the Capitol building. This is higher level mid-management, higher management. Waited a year before really even opening those files. And here we are now in the wake of that. An awful lot of people obviously participating in this process. You've got some people on Capitol Hill. You've got the Supreme Court that slow walked all of this as well. Lots of responsibility there in Washington, D.C. on all political sides. But Merrick Garland also, I think, needs to look at history, look at his own performance of his Department of Justice and say, why didn't we look at this right away? Why didn't we look at that ellipse statement, that speech and say he's inciting people to come and do exactly what he wants? He invited them to Washington, D.C. You open a file, maybe not in the hour, but after the horrific dust settles on January 6th, by January 10th, that file is opened internal to the department. Nobody's indicted yet, and the investigation is not complete, but you undertake it right away. It took the House Special Committee to prompt that happen when the Department of Justice folks are looking at that and saying, wait a minute, all of these things are happening and there are people coming and testifying before the House committee. We need to get them in the grand jury. Should go in, you and I both know it should go in the opposite direction, right? Lots of blame there, I think, as well. I agree with you. It's a good country where we can sit around and criticize our attorneys general on all sides of the political aisle.
Yes. Folks, that's Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. We're going to come back briefly with Jim after these breaks. I want to talk about pardons and prosecutions, Jim, and what might be in the works. I also want to briefly provide this fact to one of my texters from the 414. They said that Democrats take more money from big dollar donors than Republicans do. That is not true. Of the $1.9 billion spent by America's richest families on all federal campaigns this cycle, $1.36 billion, or 72% of that, went to support Republicans, while Democrats received about $413 million. Dems de facts. And I hope we all agree that regardless if the other side is doing it, money in politics is dumb and it is corrupting. Money ain't speech. Corporations aren't people. We're going to pick it right back up with Jim Santel. Your texts and calls will be welcome. And don't forget, folks, I'm going to give you some resources, a place that you can go to find about the 10 ways to be prepared and grounded now that Trump has won. All on the other side, you're going to want to keep it locked here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Y'all, I'm Maggie Dawn. I'm with Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. This half hour, let's get right to it, Jim. Pardons and prosecutions. Yes. What should we be expecting? Should Joe Biden be preemptively pardoning Jack Smith and Liz Cheney and Hillary Clinton? Should he pardon his son? Should he pardon Trump?
Right.
All of it on the table in this wacky, wild world we find ourselves in.
It's all on the table, right?
And who do you think is going to get prosecuted? Because Donald Trump is coming for people. I mean,
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so let's talk about pardons first. It's in the Constitution. And again, you and I both know, as do your listeners, this is one of the few authorities in the Constitution set up by James Madison that's virtually unchecked. And we've seen that before. Presidents on all sides of the political aisle have done things typically at the end of an administration to pardon people. But here's the important point. Here's a little piece, Maggie, you and I both know. Burdick versus United States, that established from the Supreme Court that when you take a burden, when you accept a burden, and by the way, you don't have to accept one. It's not imposed upon you. It's an acceptance of this. When you are doing that, it's called an imputation of guilt, an acceptance of a confession that you have done the crime. And so that's why Gerald Ford, remember when he walked around with that card in his pocket all those years when people would accuse him of letting Richard Nixon off? He'd say, well, you know what? Richard Nixon effectively admitted to all the things that he did. Same thing here. As Donald Trump, for example, talks about pardoning all of these, it's up to 1,200 people now responsible for the attack upon the Capitol. He can do that with virtual. He shouldn't be doing it. It should go through the office of the pardon attorney at the Department of Justice. That won't happen. There should be a showing of contrition. There should be a showing of 5 years of good behavior beyond the crime. All those standards. He's not going to follow any
of
them.
Out the window.
Out
yeah.
the window. It's not going to happen, Maggie, right? But they accept those. And they should also understand, unlike shows like this, other places out there will not make this fine point. All of those people, by accepting those pardons, are acknowledging that they engaged in criminal acts that are in violation of the federal criminal code, in violation of the norms of the people of the United States of America. That's no small thing. Joe Biden, probably at the end of his term, will issue those pardons as well. To answer your some pardons, inappropriate circumstances, going through the Department of Justice, finding those people out there who have committed crimes, who acknowledge them, who've engaged in good behavior, and therefore warrant it's an act of grace, if you will, is what the law is on this and what the expression is. Joe Biden will do that for some people here, and we're going to hear about them. Should he be pardoning himself, pardoning Hillary, pardoning? The answer is, of course, no, right? Because they've done nothing wrong. There are no crimes to pardon here. And even if Donald Trump turns around and somehow gets some of his loyalists at the Department of Justice, who he can now appoint with virtual approval by a Senate, right? They're going to approve whoever. The answer is there a stopgap there? I think there is. And again, you and I both know what it is. In order to prosecute somebody in the federal system, you got to get a grand jury to agree with you. You can investigate, and sometimes that's enough of a punishment. Being investigated is no small thing. Don't mean
well,
to.
Well, this was going to be my point, Jim, yeah. Of course, right? We know that Brad Raffensperger in Georgia spent nearly $500,000 defending what was
Absolutely.
A completely spurious case that was ultimately dismissed. This is the problem and the chilling effect that it has on frontline prosecutors. You're going to hear Jim again on Monday. He's going to be sitting in the big chair for me, folks. Thanks so much, Jim, for all of your insightful work. I'll be listening on Monday,
Maggie,
as I have a day off, sir. I thank you.
Well deserved,
greatly.
By the way, my friend. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Folks, I wanted to give you some sources and outlets for your mental health and preparedness for the next dawn of this resistance. Great, great, great resource is a place called wagingnonviolence.org. That's wagingnonviolence.org. There is a 12-page article there that has the 10 ways to be prepared and grounded now that Trump has won. I'm just going to go through the 10 things that are incredibly well prepared, well explained in that article. There's even more resources embedded within the article. We're going to put the link to the article in the show notes from today's show. You can find those at civicmedia.us/Maggie Dawn Show. First, trust yourself. I think this goes for everybody. Trust yourself. Find others whom you trust. And what that requires is trusting yourself and others whom you trust that speak the truth and are willing to have good faith conversations. We're going to need to grieve. There's going to be a grieving process. Release and let go of that which you cannot change. Find your path. There are avenues for you to get involved in ways that you may not have in the past. Find your path. Activate. It will make you feel better, I promise. There's basically four paths, by the way. There's the protecting people, there's disruption and disobey, acts that are unlawful or immoral. You build alternatives and you defend our civic institutions. I love those. Six, do not obey in advance. Do not self-censor. Do not be afraid. So super important. Reorient your political map. We clearly have to do better talking to one another. We got to respect the viewpoints and yet still consistently push forward with policies that reflect what I believe to be the vast majority of shared values across the political spectrum in this country. Eight, get real about power. Who has it, why, and what they're trying to achieve? Because I guarantee you it ain't for the middle class right now. No siree, Bob. Number nine, handle fear and rebound, meaning when you are afraid, take a breath and rebound. We can move forward. And 10, envision the positive future that you wish to see. That's going to do it for me. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But remember, it is always better when we stand together. Dom Salvia up next here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.